Today on Against the Grain, the fight against the Dakota Access Pipeline led to a remarkable level of protest and solidarity, bringing together Native people from all over North America, as well as their allies. It also witnessed a remarkable level of repression. I'm Sasha Lilly. Investigative journalist Will Parrish joins me to discuss leaked documents that expose the role of a private security firm experienced in counterterrorism and its surveillance and infiltration of protesters. I'll also be joined by Cassie Standing Bear Helgerson to discuss other threats to water in the Great Lakes region. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Starting last April, Native activists organized to stop the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline, running from oil fields in western North Dakota to southern Illinois, crossing beneath the Missouri and Mississippi rivers, as well as under part of a lake near the Standing Rock Indian Reservation. They were met with the full force of the state, including the Federal Bureau of Investigation, Homeland Security, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, along with state and local law enforcement. And now it turns out, private security companies as well, working in partnership with those state agencies who are involved in surveillance, infiltration, and a campaign of misinformation. Later in the program, I'll speak with Cassie Standing Bear Helgerson, who was at Standing Rock during the final 10 weeks of the camp, about other threats to water in the Great Lakes region. But first, I'll speak with Will Parrish, one of the journalists who has broken the story about the role of the private security firm Tiger Swan in repressing the protests against the Dakota Access Pipeline. Will, protesters against the pipeline faced, among other tactics, rubber bullets and water cannons in freezing weather. Would you say that protesters there met an extraordinary level of repression?
I absolutely would. A lot of the people who were at Standing Rock and read this story said, well, yeah, this is no surprise because we experienced the counterinsurgency style policing that took place out there. I mean, first of all, there were National Guard checkpoints in place on roadways leading into the camp, heavily militarized police with military surplus gear, similar to what has been dramatized by things like the Ferguson protests. But I think because this was a multi-month protest that was stationary in a sense, it was based around these campsites where people gathered by the thousands along the banks of the Missouri River on the North Dakota plains, the police were able to consolidate this counterinsurgency-style interagency campaign against the protesters that was characterized by massive amounts of surveillance. I think that probably these camps, such as the Ocheti-Sakoan Camp and Sacred Stone Camp, were probably among the most heavily surveilled pieces of ground on the planet for a period of time. I do think that there was an extraordinary amount of repression and surveillance and other things that I would characterize as a counterinsurgency campaign.
And why do you think that is? Is it because of what was at stake in terms of this pipeline? Was it who the protesters were, predominantly indigenous people? What do you think brought the force of the state and private entities as well down so heavily on these protesters?
Right. I think it's a combination of things, like you mentioned. The protest inspired people around the world, and the more repression that there was for a period of time, starting with the incident in September of last year when dogs bit protesters and people responded by coming out to Standing Rock and swelling the ranks of people out there. The state, I think, saw that there was a huge groundswell of support that threatened the oil industry and the gas industry and the stability of of these enterprises that are geared toward resource extraction in general, because there were, as you know, hundreds of different indigenous people from different nations that came out to Standing Rock. People from other countries around the world came out to Standing Rock. So the amount of support that it generated and the potential for copycat demonstrations and the model that was effective at Standing Rock to spread, you know, I think is considerable, and we're seeing that as these kinds of protests against other pipelines. So, you know, the state obviously recognized that. The police agencies recognized that this was a model that could spread. They decided to come down really hard on it, it seems. And, of course, also, I think the fact that it was an indigenous-led movement brings another element because of the factor that indigenous people refusing to be, refusing to conform with the settler state, opposing this project on the grounds of indigenous sovereignty is very threatening and raises the stakes because the United States government depends on cooperation of indigenous people to a large extent because of, among other things, the amount of resources that are present on indigenous reservations. About, you know, by some estimates, you know, maybe about 30% of the oil and gas in the United States is on lands that on the reservation land base of the United States. As an example, of course, you know, the network of pipelines going through indigenous lands or near indigenous lands is another factor in making sure that indigenous people are not asserting their sovereignty. So I think that, you know, along with also just the racism that came into play at Standing Rock, obviously you had a lot of police agencies involved that where racism is very much institutionalized and personal feelings of racism were at play. You know, I think all those factors combined to make this, you know, a uniquely repressive response.
So what were the different entities that were involved in repressing the protesters, whether it's surveillance or, you know, more direct repression? Paint a picture for us of the number of agencies, local, state, federal, as well as private, that were harnessed on the side of Energy Transfer Partners, the company building the Dakota Access Pipeline.
Sure. So while this first piece that we published on there is so focused on Tiger Swan, I want to emphasize that before Tiger Swan even was a part of the scene, the as I found through public records requests and other reporting, the FBI and other federal agencies, along with state and local agencies in North Dakota, had already formed an interagency intelligence group that was based at the North Dakota Fusion Center to monitor these protests and to develop strategies for containing and repressing the protests. So by August of last year, that was already in place. And as many of the people listening to this will probably recall, the protests, you know, the civil disobedience or civil resistance aspect of the protests where people were getting arrested, obstructing construction, didn't really kick off until August. So very soon after people were getting arrested, there was already that interagency intelligence group in place. So, the agencies involved included the FBI, Department of Homeland Security, Bureau of Indian Affairs, the U.S. Justice, the U.S. Attorney's Office of North Dakota was very much involved, I think, looking at prosecuting people who were involved in the protests from early on. And, you know, we've seen that play out now. There have been over 100 felony, 100 different people who are facing felony charges at this point. So, you know, those are the agencies involved, and they organize through a fusion center, which is an information sharing partnership among police agencies set up in the wake of 9/11, essentially, with guidance from the Department of Homeland Security, there are 77 fusion centers across the country at this point. So the North Dakota Fusion Center was the focal point for this interagency operation.
Well, what is Tiger Swan and how was it formed?
So Tiger Swan was formed by veterans of the U.S. Army Delta Forces, which is an elite counterinsurgency element of the military that has gained a lot of stature in the war on terrorism period of U.S. military operations. And a guy named James Reese, who brags that he was appointed by the CIA, or appointed by, rather, by Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld to oversee the CIA's role in the invasion of Iraq, and or was a lead advisor, I should say, in the invasion of Iraq for the CIA. He got into the burgeoning private security mercenary business in 2007, at a time when that business was booming. Blackwater was the most well-known and successful at the time private mercenary corporation, and he sought to compete with them through forming this company called Tiger Swan, which is based in North Carolina. And they are involved in the military contracting and State Department contracting business in numerous countries overseas. And we're just starting to learn about their, the domestic aspect of their business model, I think, through learning about the role that they played on behalf of Energy Transfer Partners.
And so what did you learn? And much of this was driven by documents that The Intercept obtained, both through a whistleblower, I guess, a leak, and from public records requests.
That's correct. So The Intercept obtained about 100 leaked documents from a contractor working for Tiger Swan on this operation. Tiger Swan had a multi-state operation. They were involved in all four states that that featured construction of this pipeline, which are North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, and Illinois. And also they were based at Energy Transfer Partners headquarters in Houston, and apparently that was where they would process the raw intelligence information they were gathering and then formulate these reports that they would share with police agencies. And the ones that we obtained were actually internal reports, so we were able to compare some of the reports that we got through public records requests they'd shared with police agencies with these internal reports. And basically, these documents paint a picture of massive surveillance, asking infiltrators with going into the camps and being at these protests to collect information on the protests, their plans, who the leaders were. And, we can only assume that these infiltrators were doing all sorts of things. We don't exactly know everything that they were doing, but certainly they fed into this massive public-private partnership style of intelligence gathering that came to characterize this operation against the protesters in all of these states. And Tiger Swan has continued to, I should also point out, Sasha, that Tiger Swan explicitly stated in some of the documents that we reviewed that they were collecting information to support prosecutions of activists. And something that I will be mentioning, or and my colleagues in a future story, is that the evidence that Tiger Swan collected, or this private intelligence operation collected, has been central to several prosecutions, including federal felony prosecutions of activists. There was a particular incident in October that led to 5 felony prosecutions of indigenous people involved in the Standing Rock movement, where the only material evidence that I've seen in reviewing the court documents for this has come from the private intelligence gathering operation, which I think should be very concerning, among many other concerning things here, because, this is basically amounts to deputizing a private security company working for an oil company to conduct the investigation aspect of a prosecution of people processing that same oil corporation. So, so they were involved on, on every level of this massive police operation, and these documents show proof of that.
Will Parrish is my guest. He's co-author of a report in The Intercept titled "Leaked Documents Reveal Counterterrorism Tactics Used at Standing Rock to, quote, defeat pipeline insurgencies." I'm Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, and we're talking about the repression that was meted out against protesters of the Dakota Access Pipeline, including by a private security firm called Tiger Swan. Now, what you're describing, Will, the kind of surveillance and infiltration, seems reminiscent of the way that the FBI used its COINTELPRO campaign against the American Indian Movement in the 1970s. But this goes in many ways beyond it, because it's operating on multiple levels, including through a private entity like Tiger Swan. And then you have the additional element of an entity like Tiger Swan that's cut its teeth in the so-called war on terror, and then it brings its sort of ideological presumptions from the war on terror, from counterterrorism, to repressing demonstrators domestically.
Yeah, there are potentially very big implications to this. I'm just starting to sort of tease out what all the implications are myself, and talking to scholars and so on to try to understand this. As you mentioned, there is a long history of domestic repression in the United States that the FBI has typically been in the lead in carrying out. And as you mentioned, the American Indian Movement was a major target of the FBI in the 70s. And in many ways, the American Indian Movement faced a more intense level of repression, including extrajudicial assassinations and brutal beatings and so on. But also, as you mentioned, the private security element, and also the fact that this is a case of the war on terrorism in many ways coming home, and many of the assumptions about these protesters being based on this war on terrorism prism that Tiger Swan clearly was operating with, potentially has very big implications if this kind of model is consolidated and becomes a standard way of dealing with protests like this. That should be very concerning for people. I think one thing that's happening here, Sasha, is that the United States government has always had a major tension, of course, to put it mildly, with indigenous people. Being a settler colonial state, the United States often contends with indigenous people attempting to assert their sovereignty, attempting to assert their claims to land and water and resources that the United States government wants. And the standard response has been to deal with those things with violent repression. But in the case of Standing Rock, that assertion of indigenous sovereignty dovetailed with the growing climate justice movement, which has arisen essentially in response to the fact that the United States is not dealing with climate change in a serious way, I would say, at this point, and is continuing to permit and enable massive exploitation of petroleum resources, construction of infrastructure to support a massive fossil fuel industry. And people increasingly are addressing that contradiction through engaging in campaigns such as Standing Rock, which were, was characterized by a lot of resistance, a lot of civil disobedience, and mass arrests of people. And what we're seeing, instead of the United States dealing with climate change, they are countering, the state is essentially countering the resistance to the fossil fuel industry through increased surveillance and repression. And so I think under the Trump administration, certainly that dynamic is going to continue to play out increasingly. And one thing that stood out to me in the documents we reviewed is the Tiger Swan came to the conclusion in their internal reports that this model of, as they put it, private security combined with intel, you know, which they are referring there to agencies like the FBI and the Fusion Center, is now a proven model for thwarting pipeline insurgencies. And the term pipeline insurgencies is an exact term that they use. So I think that this is a model that they are going to look to apply in other situations, potentially, should there be movements like Standing Rock that arise, certainly in the next few years.
Well, one of the things that's striking in the report you co-authored about the activity by this private security firm, Tiger Swan, which was hired by Energy Transfer Partners to try and repress protests against the Dakota Access Pipeline. One of the things that's striking is how they carried out attempts to not just exploit divisions inside the camp, turn people against each other, but also to try and craft another narrative about the Dakota Access Pipeline and create a campaign of counter-information. Tell us about that.
Yeah, one of the documents that we got was an overview of the private security company's basically mission at Standing Rock. And among the elements of that mission was to protect the reputation of Energy Transfer Partners. So as a result, you know, we saw Tiger Swan tracking media coverage of the protests very closely, tracking the Facebook activities of people opposed to the pipeline very closely, and eventually developing their own counter-information campaign sort of covertly on Facebook. And they developed websites anonymously and Facebook pages anonymously to put out information that essentially attempted to portray people opposed to the pipeline as violent, threatening criminals that were unpredictable and needed to be reined in by any means necessary. So, you know, for example, one page on a website they set up, which is something to the effect of medicine.org, is just a list of people who had been arrested at Standing Rock and their past criminal histories with photos of them. And they presented this as though it was a news story that that some sort of independent journalist had created. So, you know, that's one aspect of the campaign that they waged. And, you know, so these companies apparently are also being, you know, it's something to be aware of, I think, for people who are consumers of social media and online news. I mean, this is one aspect of the campaign that they carried out.
And it sounds like they also, along with, you know, federal agencies presumably doing the same, that they also used social media as a way to track what activists were doing and thinking and talking about.
They definitely did. In the documents we got evidence of an enormous effort to surveil people on social media, in both the public documents, most of which we haven't released yet, and these Tiger Swan reports. Both the public, you know, police agencies I mentioned earlier and Tiger Swan were routinely looking at people's Facebook and Twitter feeds. In the case of the Fusion Center intelligence group, every day they were sending out posts from people's Facebook pages. There's a lot of evidence that they basically sat around looking at Facebook live stream videos that people were putting on their Facebook pages as protests were happening, I think, both to monitor the protests and respond to them based on that information, as well as gather information for potential prosecutions. For instance, there are a couple of people I'm aware of who are facing state felony charges based on Facebook posts that they made about an incident they were involved in October. So the surveillance of social media accounts was central to this overall intelligence campaign.
Tiger Swan is a private company. How do you understand that, and it wasn't the only private security company operating on the behest of Energy Transfer Partners to try and stop opposition to the Dakota Access Pipeline. How do you understand a private company like this working with local, state, and federal law enforcement. How exactly, what's the mechanism that allows a private company to sort of slot into that larger network of law enforcement?
Right, that's an excellent question. My understanding of that is that since 9/11, there's been a loosening of rules around information sharing among private and public agencies, starting with the USA Patriot Act through a series of pieces of legislation since then that have not only loosened those rules, but encouraged information sharing among public and private agencies and collaboration among public and private agencies, public agencies and private security companies, I should say. So, for instance, the FBI even has a formal partnership with the oil and gas industry to share intelligence information called something like the FBI Oil and Gas Special Interest Group. And it has, there are various other partnerships like this that have formed in recent years. So this sort of collaboration has been formalized through, I think, a discourse on critical infrastructure protection. Critical infrastructure is a term used by the domestic security state basically to refer to infrastructure and installations that are crucial to the economy of the United States. During the Keystone XL pipeline protests, for example, there was a story in The Guardian a few years back about how the FBI had referred to the Keystone XL pipeline, which was still under review from the Obama administration at the time, as a critical infrastructure that is critical to the national security of the United States. So that critical infrastructure discourse has been the mechanism, I think, or a mechanism for fusing private and private agencies such as Tiger Swan with the domestic security state. Because it's important to point out here, Sasha, that while we focused on Tiger Swan in this report, they would not be operating in this way without at least the tacit approval of agencies like the FBI.
Sure.
And, any more than Blackwater, for example, would be operating without the support of the U.S. military overseas, you might say. So this, this is something that I think has grown out of, in part at least, the change in both the culture and the practices of the domestic security state since 9/11.
Investigative journalist Will Parrish is my guest. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. We're talking about the repression of protests against the Dakota Access Pipeline, including by a private security firm, Tiger Swan. Now, Will, I would imagine that you would not be sanguine about state entities suppressing protests, but I want to ask you why you think it is particularly dangerous when a for-profit private security company is involved in repression.
Sure. Well, for one thing, in the case of public police agencies, while certainly I'm opposed to, people should be very much opposed to the repression that they're meeting out as well, which, happens routinely, there is at least a layer of accountability that is at least possible with public police agencies that is not possible with private police agencies. The FBI, in theory at least, has oversight from Congress, and that oversight is obviously very much lacking. But in the case of Tiger Swan, there's not that potential for accountability in nearly the same way. Tiger Swan is a for-profit entity that is accountable mainly to Energy Transfer Partners, a Fortune 500 oil and gas corporation that has as its sole purpose, by definition, to develop fossil fuel infrastructure to the maximum extent that it can profitably. So, there's that accountability issue, and also related to that, it's very difficult to know what the standards are that this company, that this entity is operating by. They don't have standards in place, as far as I can see, of that guide their activities, that, you know, an agency, you know, like local police agencies perhaps would. There's simply, you know, what we have gotten so far, these leaked internal documents, suggest that they will do basically anything that they can possibly get away with in order to fulfill the mission that they are tasked with carrying out. You know, another thing, Sasha, I think, is that what we are seeing, I think, globally to some extent, is that the oil and gas industry is militarizing itself increasingly. The budgets for private security that oil and gas companies have developed, you know, are growing up substantially. I saw a report, the oil and gas industry's budget for private security operations has gone from something like $15 billion globally in 2011 to a projected, you know, doubling of that by 2021. And I think that this is, in a sense, at least, you know, to some degree, a response to the existential crisis and crisis of legitimacy that the oil and gas industry faces as they are pressured to basically go out of business and face stranded asset problems all over the world, where in order for there to be a stable climate where people can live in the future, the oil and gas industry basically needs to go away. And they are, instead of drawing down their operations voluntarily, they're doing everything that they can to stay in business. And one thing that they are doing to try to stay in business is basically becoming an arm of the domestic security state as much as they can get away with through using private security companies like Tiger Swan. So I guess, you know, related to your question, why is it worse for the private security and companies like Tiger Swan to be meeting out this repression? Well, you know, basically it's a question of, would you rather have the United States government empowered to meet out this repression, or would you rather have the oil and gas industry empowered to meet out this kind of repression? And, you know, I would, out of both of those options, which are both quite bad, I would tend to pick the United States government because, you know, of the accountability issue that I mentioned.
And is there also not the issue of, for a for-profit entity, that there's a self-perpetuating aspect, that because profit itself can be a logic, that an entity like a Tiger Swan or another private security company might overstate, so to speak, the threat that it's been hired to put out and magnify it just to make sure it keeps, you know, getting the work?
Absolutely. That's a great point. And, you know, there are a couple of researchers in Canada who have studied that issue, who I've become familiar with, who refer to this as a petro-security complex, where essentially, as you said, in the case of Tiger Swan specifically, you know, this company has portrayed the water protectors at Standing Rock in the most menacing light I could possibly imagine in these reports, and it had explicitly compared them to jihadists, trying to liken them to the greatest boogeyman that they can, that would be considered a threat to the security of these oil and gas companies. And so this trend that that we see in the reports is that the more the Tiger Swan is involved, the more it seemed that they felt justified in portraying people in such a way as to continue to be supported in what they were doing by Energy Transfer Partners and perpetuate the relationship, which is obviously a lucrative one for them.
One of the things that was striking in your report about what you all gleaned at The Intercept with these leaked documents from Tiger Swan was, as you mentioned, you know, that they even liken the protesters to jihadists, but that they also, in their dealings, in their surveillance, they actually focused on Middle Eastern activists at Standing Rock?
In a number of cases, they specifically highlighted Palestinian American activists who had traveled to Standing Rock. Another person who is a Muslim American activist whose work is to promote solidarity with indigenous people of the United States was flagged by the private security operation, and in a document that I got through public records request, a sheriff, deputy sheriff, rather, in North Dakota, forwarded that information to the interagency intelligence group that consists of the FBI and the other agencies I mentioned. And the sole reason that I could determine that this individual was flagged in this way is that she was Muslim American and had traveled overseas. And so we see the racist underpinnings of the war on terrorism carrying over into this campaign of domestic repression that singles out Muslim American people for enhanced suspicion and surveillance and criminalization as well.
Let me end by asking you about the cases of six water protectors. Now, many people have been charged with felonies, people who have been protesters against the Dakota Access Pipeline. Yet in this case, you're particularly concerned about the charges that have been leveled against these six people, all indigenous. Can you tell us about their cases and why they're notable?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So there are six federal felonies charges that I'm aware of, at least, that have been filed against people involved in the protests at Standing Rock. All six of the individuals facing these charges are indigenous people. And among the counts that they all face is federal civil disorder, which is a charge based on a statute passed in the 1960s that was an amendment to the Fair Housing Act of 1968, in fact. It was basically written by a Southern segregationist senator from Louisiana who used it as a quid pro quo for his votes in favor of this legislation, which narrowly passed. And he explicitly targeted black rioters, as he called them, who he said were threatening to destroy the fabric of the United States. And he specifically mentioned Stokely Carmichael and H. Rapp Brown as in floor speeches that he gave in support of this amendment. And so this heavily racialized amendment to this legislation is now being applied against these six Standing Rock protesters. And I find that history notable. I also find it notable that this legislation essentially enables wide latitude to pursue prosecutions of people who are engaged in civil disobedience. And it's the sort of thing that prosecutors maybe you'd like to test out from time to time and see how far that they can push this sort of prosecution. And so I think that these cases are potentially significant if people are convicted on these grounds for basically being involved in a highway blockade at Standing Rock, which is what they're accused of doing, that we could see that sort of charge be used in other situations as well, increasingly.
Will Parrish, I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much, Sasha. It's been great to talk to you.
That's Will Parrish, investigative journalist and co-author of the report in The Intercept titled "Leaked Documents Reveal Counterterrorism Tactics Used at Standing Rock to, quote, defeat pipeline insurgencies." You can find a link to that report on our website, againstthegrain.org. And now we turn to water protector Cassie Standing Bear Helgerson, who was at the Standing Rock camp during the last 10 weeks. Clearly, opposition to the Dakota Access Pipeline brought needed attention to threats to water. Cassie, you were involved in opposing the Dakota Access Pipeline. What are the other threats to water in the region that you're most concerned about?
Well, for one, we have the KXL, which is
the Keystone XL pipeline.
Keystone XL. And that one has already been fought and defeated, and now it has been brought back. There are similar fights like that, not even just in the United States, but all over the world. For me personally, I, living in Minnesota, we've gotten very, very upset about the pipelines that we have there. Well, it turns out that Enbridge, which is the company we have in Minnesota, also owns like 25% of the Dakota Access Pipeline. So the project that they're working on now is Line 3 and Line 5. Line 3 and Line 5 both are existing pipelines. They're talking about a Line 3 replacement, which when I think of a replacement, I think of, you know, you get something new and you take out the old and put the new in. That's not the case. That's not what they're planning on doing. They're planning on starting along the route of the current one with a new pipeline, a bigger pipeline, and then going farther south, which will bring it through more lakes and rivers and wetlands, wild rice beds, and putting that new one in and not removing the old one. They want to just abandon it and leave it there, which we already know it's not safe. There's been 900 anomalies on that thing, and it's not completely buried. There are places where that you can see the pipe and you can see it degrading, and it's only a matter of time before it starts polluting even worse than it has been. In addition to that, we have Line 5. Line 5 is actually two pipelines that go under Lake Superior. Not buried, not 100 feet under, or even 10 feet under. It is laying on the floor of Lake Superior.
So, in effect, in the lake.
In the lake, yes. And Lake Superior is 20% of the world's freshwater supply on the face of this planet. Everybody. So it doesn't just affect us, it affects everyone. And those two pipes underneath there, divers have gone down and taken pictures. The protective layer that's supposed to keep it from leaking into our lake is already crumbling. And this is a company that was responsible for the Kalamazoo pipeline leak. And that one hasn't even been cleaned up. Their idea of cleaning it up, they took part of it out, and then they threw grass mats over the rest, where that I've talked to people who have gone there and walked on it, and when they step down, oil comes up. So Enbridge is a company that does not take care of their spills. They are not taking care of their pipes. And they want to go through treaty land. And I don't know if you know about the treaty land, but in Minnesota, they have hunting and fishing rights, gathering rights, and the right to protect those, because in giving the hunting and fishing and gathering rights, it has to be food that they can eat. So if it is polluted by the pipeline, they can't eat that. You know, it would be like walking up to your child and saying, here's a glass of crude oil. Drink it. Line 5 goes through the Mackinac Straits. So it comes down from Canada, goes through our lake, and then back up into Canada. We don't even get any of the oil. We get no benefits, but we're taking all the risk.
So you're saying on some broad level, this isn't just simply about where you can build pipelines and who has the ability to put them through, but on a much broader level, there's a fundamental challenge to Native people having the right to gather and to do the necessities of survival on their own land.
There is. There is. And the fact that they have that right to ensure that it is clean and safe to eat or drink, and it's not going to be safe if these pipelines are running right through the middle of it and leaking. You know, they have leaks, and then the Kalamazoo one was leaking for a long time, and they said, oh, it just needs to be pressurized. So instead of going and checking, they pumped more through there. And I believe it was a fisherman that found the leak. So they don't have a good history of doing it. And once you introduce something like that through wetlands, it is polluting. It's going to kill off the fish. The plants are going to die. And what they're pushing through there, bitumen, that's what's going through there. And that's worse than just the crude oil. It's worse because they have to add toxic and corrosive chemicals to it in order to make it flow through the pipes.
So this is coming from the tar sands in Canada, which already, to be processed, have to go through a whole chemical process to try and convert it.
Yeah, and that's for line 5. Line 3 is basically the same thing, but it's coming from the tar sands in North Dakota. And they're increasing it to over 700,000 barrels a day. But they've made it very clear that they can bump that up to over 900,000 barrels a day.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and I'm speaking with Cassie Standing-Bear-Helgeson. She's a water protector from Duluth, Minnesota, descendant of Chief Standing Bear of the Oglala Lakota Nation. So if this didn't sound bad enough of the pipelines that either exist or being expanded, the region also faces another level of threat to its water, including on Native lands, and that is from mining. Can you tell us about the mining, who's behind it, and why it's of such great concern?
Northern Minnesota has a long history of mining, and there have been issues with it, but it's nothing compared to what is trying to be put in there right now. Twin Metals is trying to put in a copper nickel mine right on the border of the Boundary Waters Wilderness Canoe Area, which is supposed to be protected. You can't even take a motorboat there. It's no motorized anything. It is one of the most pristine places left on our planet. And if they build this mine there, the end result of this mine is sulfuric acid. That's what comes out of the rocks that they have to expose to extract this. So their job is to take out these rocks, get the small amounts of copper and nickel and other metals out of there that they can use, and then to store what's left in a manner that will keep it from getting wet in a state that is known as the land of 10,000 lakes. And that right there tells you it's a very water-rich environment, and sulfide mining has never been done in a water-rich environment successfully. But they think they can do that and keep it from getting wet for 500 years. When it does happen. And when this leaks out, it's on the Laurentian Divide, where the water flows in both directions, north and south. So
flowing where?
North and south from the Laurentian Divide. It's going to flow north into Canada and pollute them, and it's going to flow south in the United States. It's going to go down to, it's going to get to Lake Superior. It's going to go through the St. Louis Riverway, which also crosses native lands, and it'll eventually get into the Mississippi. I've seen places that were mined many, many years ago where the sulfuric acid got out. And to this day, those waterways are polluted. They're orange. They're fluorescent orange, and nothing lives in them.
That's water protector Cassie Standing Bear Helgerson, descendant of Chief Standing Bear of the Oglala Lakota. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.